Today is Monday, May 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, after decades on the run for his role in Rwanda's horrific genocide and arrest in Paris.
He has some 11 children living in Europe, so he had a large network of support across the continent. Officials here in Paris say that it was those children that protected him for all that time.
U.S. President Donald Trump announces plans to fast-track a vaccine by the end of the year. Also ahead, We Are the World gets a remake by American Idol alumni. It's all on today's International Edition. After eluding arrest for 26 years, Rwandan genocide suspect Felicien Kabuga, who's accused of funding militias that massacred about 800,000 people, was arrested Saturday near Paris. The 84-year-old, who is Rwanda's most wanted man, had a $5 million U.S. bounty on his head and was living under a false identity, according to France's Justice Ministry. Joining us now for details is Paris-based journalist Catherine Field. Catherine, how did this arrest finally happen?
It was in a suburb on the outskirts of Paris, the northwest of Paris. He had been living in a very standard French apartment for quite some time, according to the neighbors. The arrest followed immense exchange of information between seven European jurisdictions, as well as Rwandan officials. The special unit of the Ministry of the Interior here in France that is responsible for combating crimes against humanity, genocide, and war crimes carried out the arrest early in the morning. They said that it really wasn't until the last minute they were absolutely sure that they had this man. They said that they had DNA samples which they had received from the German authorities, and it was only after they compared the DNA samples, once they had Felicien Kabuga in custody, that they knew they had this man.
How did he elude capture all of these years?
He was expelled from Switzerland in 1994. He then moved to Kinshasa. He was allegedly in Kenya, in Nairobi, right up until about 2002. Apparently, he was protected there by various friends. He was last seen in 2007 in Frankfurt, in Germany. After that, the trail went cold. Allegedly, he still has very large sums of money. This is a man who is very wealthy. He has some 11 children living in Europe, so he had a large network of support across the continent. Officials here in Paris say that it was those children that protected him for all that time.
I understand the UN Criminal Tribunal will be responsible for a trial?
They will indeed. There's a few bureaucratic hurdles to go through before that. The French public prosecutor will put all the evidence early this week before an extradition hearing. It is then liable to go before a court of appeal here in Paris. And then the question is whether he is transferred to The Hague, which is now the headquarters, the UN mechanism that took over the outstanding cases from Rwanda and from the former Yugoslavia. That is what it's expected will happen, that he will be transferred to The Hague as opposed to being transferred in the first instance to Tanzania, to Arusha.
And what about Rwanda? I would think that there would be some desire to have him face extradition back there where it happened.
Yes, that has always been the big question as to who actually gets their hands on the suspect. And of course, it was this UN tribunal that had issued this arrest warrant for Felicien Kabuga. It was that warrant that the French authorities acted on. So they are obliged to hand him over.
It's definitely something that is still fresh in their memory. They're wounded, they're heartbroken. Is there any understanding as to why this man was so interested in financing this horror?
At this stage, we really don't know, apart from the fact that it was from right at the very start. In 1991, this man started supporting these militias, started financing their trainings, buying them weapons. He was also, of course, the owner of a radio station in Rwanda that just spewed out hatred. So it was known that early on that he was involved with these extremist Hutu militias. cases. So these sorts of real nitty-gritty evidence that we're liable to see will come through this trial when it eventually does come to trial. Of course, the big question is, when will it come to trial? This man is now 84 years old. If we believe what his neighbours are saying in Paris, he's ill, he has trouble walking. So we're looking at the question of an old man, very ill, will he ever come to trial?
What does this arrest say about relations between France and Rwanda now?
One has to remember that diplomatic relations between France and Rwanda were severed for many years. There was a real feeling by Rwanda that France wasn't living up to its international obligations to arrest some of the suspects of the genocide who were living in France. So the fact that Franco-Rwandan relations are back on track probably helped significantly to bring this arrest around. Certainly it wouldn't have happened without French President Emmanuel Macron giving the green light. Let's think back to April 2019. French President Emmanuel Macron announced the opening of French archives from that crucial period in Rwanda, 1990 to 1994, when France had been accused of giving military assistance to the regime. So Emmanuel Macron has opened that file. He has got a commission of historians working on those files. And it is expected that by April 2021, some sort of tracing of those files will be made public. So the fact that these relations have come so far, that Emmanuel Macron will have given the green light, just shows that a page has been turned. There was a really sad episode between France and Rwanda when it was felt that France was really not playing the role that it was expected of it in the international community, and that it is prepared to act in a manner that is expected of a serious United Nations Security Council member when it comes to bringing people accused of 7 counts of genocide to trial.
Paris-based journalist Catherine Field. The United States is approaching another somber milestone as the number of COVID-19 deaths approaches 90,000. President Donald Trump unveiled Operation Warp Speed, an initiative aimed at developing a coronavirus vaccine by the end of the year. He also vowed that the country would reopen with or without a vaccine. This week, the Trump administration has also laid out plans to expand an initiative to ensure the U.S. does not run out of critical medical supplies. White House correspondent Patsy Wuda-Kuswara reports.
Thank you very much.
U.S. President Donald Trump intends to have hundreds of millions of coronavirus vaccine doses available by January 2021.
It's called Operation Warp Speed. That means big and it means fast.
Most public health experts agree it's an ambitious timeline, but they say it may be possible to have a vaccine ready for emergency use on high-risk groups, such as healthcare workers and the elderly.
Everything would have to go perfectly. I think for the general population, we are really still looking at an 18-month endeavor here, if all goes well.
With an election looming in November, Trump is also keeping his eye on reopening the country and its economy.
Vaccine or no vaccine, we're back. And we're starting the process. And in many cases, they don't have vaccines, and a virus or a flu comes, and you fight through it.
Trump has expressed support for protesters who want individual states to lift stay-at-home orders and open their economies, though many do not meet his own administration's criteria to do so. Some include so-called red states that voted for Trump in 2016. Analysts say Trump's support for protesters may hurt him politically if states that reopen too early see a rise in the number of coronavirus cases.
It is a big risk to take. And what we're seeing now with cases emerging in rural areas and in places where Trump has been strongest, the red states and the red parts of blue states, suggests that this could be a gambit that could backfire.
Earlier this week, Trump also announced plans to ensure the nation has enough supply of medical and emergency gear.
Instead of 1 to 3 weeks worth of supplies, which we had less than that, the U.S. government will now stockpile 3 whole months, much of it made in the USA.
The Trump administration has been criticized by some for the country's lack of personal protective equipment in the early weeks of the pandemic. Replenishing the strategic national stockpile is seen as critical.
It's really important that we do everything we can now to prepare for a fall or winter pandemic wave when we will likely have both flu as well as COVID-19 at the same time.
The administration plans to expand American manufacturing of these medical supplies to reduce reliance on foreign companies and create jobs domestically. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News, Washington.
Zimbabwe's leader has extended a lockdown to contain COVID-19, which has officially infected 42 people in the poverty-stricken nation. Public health experts say the extension is the right move. But as Columbus Mavunga in Harare reports for VOA, jobless informal workers are asking the government to pay them.
In a televised address, President Emmerson Mnangagwa said he's worried by increasing cases of local transmission of the coronavirus in Zimbabwe, and the country is not yet in a position to lift the lockdown.
Zimbabwe will therefore continue on the level 2 lockdown for an indefinite period. We shall have regular 2-week interval reviews to assess progress or lack of it. This should give us more time to strengthen the prevention and case management approaches for the various risk populations. Social and physical distancing will continue to be maintained and enforced at all times. I appeal to our people to exercise greater self-discipline in this regard. Our individual and collective roles in the fight against this pandemic can never be overemphasized.
The United Nations says Zimbabwe is facing a plethora of humanitarian problems, such as recurring droughts, food insecurity, and a collapsing economy, and needs international assistance. One of those feeling the pinch is 28-year-old Trevor River, who sells building materials in one of Harare's poor townships. He wants the government to pay him as long as there is a lockdown and he can't work.
The lockdown is quite difficult, and the impact that we are facing right now, it's quite huge because we are no longer selling. It's like the source of our income has been cut short. So it's quite difficult for us to survive.
Earlier this week, police arrested some members of the political opposition who participated in a demonstration demanding the government pay those who can't earn a living because of the coronavirus lockdown. Zimbabwe Association of Doctors for Human Rights head Fortune Yamande says the country is too far from ready to lift its lockdown. He said he sympathizes, though, with the unemployed. We have had no source of income since late March when restrictions were imposed.
The WHO specifies that for a country to lift a lockdown, it should not have widespread community transmission. It must have conducted adequate testing so that it can reflect on the true extent of the disease. The health system should be well equipped to respond to any surge in cases of COVID. Then finally, the government should have the capacity to test, isolate, and trace all the conducts of those who test positive for COVID-19. So, basing on this criteria, we still think that there's a lot that needs to be done. But however, extending the lockdown without addressing to these four fundamental issues raised by the WHO is futile.
Some informal traders are not waiting for the government to pay them. They are defying the lockdown and flooding the streets of Harare, selling their wares to make money. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
United Nations and private aid agencies warned Friday that an unprecedented number of people in Africa's volatile Sahel region are in desperate need of life-saving assistance and protection. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Aid agencies say they are alarmed but not surprised by the extent of the humanitarian crisis gripping the Sahel. Years of conflict in half a dozen countries, terrorist attacks, climate change causing food insecurity, and now the COVID-19 pandemic have stripped the population of its ability to protect and provide for itself. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs reports 24 million people, or one in five of the Sahel's total population of 120 million, need international assistance and protection to survive. This is the highest number ever recorded. OCHA spokesman Jens Laerke says children account for half of those affected.
The multi-layered crisis is triggered by a deterioration in security that has led to displacement within countries and across borders, rising hunger, inequality, and the direct and indirect consequences of the COVID-19 pandemic, including a reported rise in gender-based violence.
The UN reports escalating conflict and instability in Mali, Niger, Burkina Faso, northeast Nigeria, Chad, and northern Cameroon have displaced 4.5 million people in the region, both internally and as refugees. It notes 12 million people are short of food, with many on the brink of starvation, and 1.6 million children are severely malnourished. Aid agencies warn the lean season between June and August, when food stocks are exhausted, will worsen the situation. Another flashpoint is the growing number of coronavirus cases in the region, currently at more than 9,000. The United Nations has appealed for $2.8 billion to reach 17 million people in need. So far, only 18% of the funds has been received. In response to the COVID-19 pandemic in the Sahel, the UN requested an additional $638 million earlier this month. Aid agencies say failure to support emergency operations in the Sahel will cost many more lives and devastate communities. They warn this humanitarian crisis could spill into new regions and into West African coastal countries if life-saving needs are ignored. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In Europe, Italy, which was early on overwhelmed with coronavirus cases, is now officially beginning to reopen this week. The Italian government has given the green light to open the country, but tourists will face strict rules in hotels, restaurants, and on beaches. Sabina Castelfranco has more for VOA.
Since early March, very strict COVID-19 lockdown measures have been in place in Italy. But starting Monday, the country will be slowly returning to a new normal. The government has established general guidelines for the entire country, while each region may adopt its own changes depending on the particular situation. The national government may decide to close certain areas again at any time should there be a spike in new coronavirus infections. The first death from coronavirus in Italy was February 21st. Since then, 31,600 people have died in the country from the virus. Italy suffered the third highest death toll in the world. Italians can now be seen again walking in the streets of their cities, wearing protective masks and gloves, and beginning Monday, all shops can reopen to the public with new rules. Social distancing of at least 1 meter must continue to be maintained, and only a designated number of people at a time will be able to enter stores. Italians will be able to return to bars, restaurants, and beauty salons. Social distancing rules apply, and waiters and owners will have to wear face masks at all times. Italians can travel within their region starting Monday and from region to region and abroad beginning June 3rd. Tourists can return starting June 3rd as well. Additionally, church services will resume, though only a certain number will be allowed to attend. This parish priest explains that churches will be completely sanitized at the end of every day. Schools, universities, cinemas and theaters remain closed for the time being. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
In the 5 or so months since the world first began to cope with what is now the worst pandemic in living memory, health workers continue to put their lives on the line. For the next part of our ongoing series of interviews with those brave people on the front lines in America's hospitals, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with nurse Raina Moret, who helps manage other nurses and healthcare workers in the COVID units at Jackson Memorial Hospital in Miami, Florida.
I have been in that unit now for a little bit over a month, helping stabilize the unit, helping manage the flow of the unit, and helping manage the nurses, just making sure everybody's wearing proper PPE and being a support system for the staff and patients themselves.
So you were the patients too?
I'm not their primary nurse, but I do have to go into the room many times when they have questions or concerns. The truth is, the patients that are here are very scared. You're alone. They don't know what's going on. They see these astronaut-looking people going into their rooms day in and day out, and just to have them be able to connect helps them a lot.
Has it been hard for you personally to adjust to working constantly on a COVID ward?
At the beginning, I was terrified. But the fact that Jackson has given us what we need in order to feel safe has helped a lot. We always have what we need to work together and protect everybody, both the patient and the nurses. If healthcare workers do not protect themselves, we can be carriers and we can be the ones spreading this even more than what is being spread already.
Do you have enough nursing staff?
So I've been very blessed to have nurses who want to come back out and work in these units because of how safe they feel. They'd rather work in a COVID unit knowing what to expect than work in a regular floor where they don't know who has COVID.
You can have great protection, but there is still so much that is unknown about COVID-19.
It's exactly what you just said. You do not know who really has COVID or not until they are swabbed and come back positive.
How have you managed to cope with all this uncertainty and trauma?
At the beginning, it was very hard for me. In the first few weeks from being in a COVID unit, I found myself just wanting to lay in bed all day. I was seeing what nurses were going through. I was seeing what patients were going through. I was seeing the hard truth of what this virus does. Nursing takes a toll on you physically, mentally, on a regular day. And now you throw in a virus that we don't know about. It's just an added stress to you. So I had to find a way to cope with it. I had to find a way to know that giving all that I can is making a difference. I would love to get back to my normal life, but until then, I am here. I'm here to fight this war, and I am proud to be part of a healthcare system that truly shows that they care about their nurses and always make sure that they feel safe in this crazy world that we're living right now.
Do you think that the public is actually grateful for everything you guys are doing?
The support that we are receiving from the community is amazing. On a daily basis, I receive multiple messages through Facebook or Instagram from people who don't even know me, just reaching out and saying, hey, thank you for helping. You know, like when a lot of us are afraid and at home, you guys are out there and doing everything you can for these patients.
What's your personal situation?
I have two boys. They are currently with my parents who have been taking care of them for the past month and a half. It's been very hard for them, especially for the little one. He doesn't understand why he can't come around mom or why I can't hug him or why I can't give him a kiss. So I'm very lonely right now.
What is the outlook, in your opinion, going forward?
We're projecting hopefully by June to see a drop in numbers. But that all depends on the public and how they react to the opening of certain areas in the city.
Here in New York, and I think it's also true in Miami, people are going out without masks on. That must feel almost like a personal affront.
It really is. When I'm on my way to work, I'm just astonished. I see what I'm going through and what my nurses are going through. And when I come out to the public, it just hurts. The fact that people are not taking this as serious as they should be. Due to that, we're going to see an increase in numbers. It's mandatory to wear a mask. But in my own building where I live in, people are not wearing masks. They just get into the elevators with their fellow neighbors, and I don't know what planet they're living in. The least we can do is protect one another.
Here are some of the other stories we are following at VOA. Afghan President Ashraf Ghani and his rival Abdullah Abdullah signed a power-sharing deal to end a months-long political stalemate. Ghani's spokesman said on Sunday that this could be a step to smooth efforts to end the country's long-running war. Abdullah would lead the Council for Peace Talks with the insurgent Taliban, and his team members would be included in the cabinet. A new life-threatening inflammatory syndrome associated with COVID-19 has affected 230 children in Europe and killed two so far this year, as medics worldwide are told to be on alert. The Swedish-based European Center for Disease Prevention and Control said in a risk report that two children had succumbed to the condition, one in Britain and one in France. And Britain could experience a transport revolution sparked by the coronavirus pandemic, with up to 14 million people ready to swap cars for bikes. However, some experts say the opportunity could be lost if towns and cities fail to follow Department of Transport guidance to provide new emergency infrastructure such as pop-up cycle lanes. Stay with VOA for all the latest U.S. and world news. It's taken three deadlocked elections, a year and a half of political paralysis, and another three-day delay because of political infighting. But now, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has finally been sworn in his new government in Israel. AP correspondent Karen Shamas reports.
The Israeli PM and his rival turned partner, Benny Gantz, announced their appointments for the new government, the most bloated in Israeli history, with an expected 36 cabinet ministers and 16 deputies. Critics have already accused the government of being out of touch by creating so many cabinet posts at a time when unemployment has soared to 25% as a result of the coronavirus pandemic. Their controversial power-sharing deal calls for each leader to serve as prime minister for 18 months at a time, starting with Netanyahu. Their blocks will also have a similar number of ministers and mutual veto power over most major decisions. I'm Karen Shamas.
You're listening to International Edition. We'll be right back.
Border Crossings.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London.
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour.
Whoa.
Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews.
Ooh.
Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA. Or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on The Voice of America.
What's going on, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi coming to you from the Voice of America studios here in Washington, D.C. Join us each week on Upfront as we discuss a range of topics. The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
Eliminate the mentality that girls cannot do what boys can do.
You basically need to go to school. There's just no way you're going to get all the skills that people want from you or they expect from you if you're not at school.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
That AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
VOA's International Edition continues. And in the midst of a global pandemic, an updated encore of the collaborative celebrity charity single We Are the World, which was recorded back in 1985. This time, courtesy of the stars of American Idol judges Lionel Richie, who wrote the song with the late Michael Jackson, Perry, and country singer Luke Bryan, performed the song on Sunday alongside former stars and winners of the hit TV talent show. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our fabulous producer, Jackson Vunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for listening. Take care and be well.
God's great big family and the truth. You know love is all we need. We are the world. We are.
This is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music.
Wake up, dance this music.
Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.